all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Good afternoon, listeners to Veterans Radio. We're glad to have you with us today. It's a beautiful day here in Michigan, a fantastic summer day. It's also the Yankee Air Museum's Thunder Over Michigan, which we've been talking about for better than a month now on Veterans Radio, so hopefully you got out to see a little bit of that. And even if you were just in the general southeast Michigan area, you probably saw the birds flying. I know on my drive in, the Thunderbirds flew right overhead, so I knew this was going to be a great show today, and we've got a couple of experienced pilots lined up to talk to you. In our first segment, we're going to talk about the A-10 airframe and whether or not it's time to retire, and we're going to have Colonel Roger Saddell, a retired colonel who's got thousands of hours under his belt to talk about the A-10 airframe. And we're also going to talk about a Korean War ace, Cecil Foster, with Major David Vaughn, retired, who also has thousands of hours of flight time under his belt. But we're going to start this afternoon with talking about one of our sponsors from Schoolcraft College. And we'll also get a report from the field from Bob Gould on things that are occurring that he wants to let us know about. But maybe we can start with Lori Katua Snyder, Associate Dean of Advising at Schoolcraft College. Lori, say hi to the listeners at Veterans Radio.
Hi, everyone. Nice to be on your show today.
Lori, we're glad to have you on and glad to have Schoolcraft College as part of the Veterans Radio family. Maybe a good place for us to start is a little bit about Schoolcraft College.
Thank you, Jim. Well, Schoolcraft College is a public community college. We're located in Livonia, Michigan. We also have a campus in Garden City, and we're conveniently located easily off of 275, and we're right on Haggerty Road. We have approximately 13,000 total students, and just if I can give a little plug in there, Jim, we are currently registering for fall term, and we will continue to register till the end of the month, so come and see us soon.
Well, that's great, and I know nowadays online education is a big thing. Is that something that Schoolcraft College is also involved in?
Absolutely, Jim. We have a very large selection of online classes. In fact, some of our degrees can be completed entirely online. The online format is the same amount of rigor that a student will find if they're on ground in a classroom. They have to participate with their instructors and the other students in the classroom through an application we call Blackboard, and Blackboard becomes the classroom. But if at any time the student does need to meet with the instructor, that can also be arranged as well. And so if it's a very growing type of learning.
And quickly, Lori, could you mention some of the types of degrees or certificates that one can get at Schoolcraft College?
Oh, sure. Well, the first type of degrees really are transfer degrees. And the transfer degrees are degrees in the liberal arts, business, education, fine arts, and or engineering. And these are degrees that we've created to pair with our partner university and colleges in Michigan for a very simple transition into comparable bachelor's degrees. And then we also offer applied science degrees in dozens of different majors, such as culinary, nursing, applied business, welding, manufacturing. There's just dozens of different majors. These majors were designed for students to get training and to start work immediately.
And Lori, I wanted to also make sure before we run out of time, you do two things, and I want you to talk a little bit about the Veterans Resource Center at Schoolcraft College, and I certainly want you to also give the how folks can reach you or reach the college through the website.
No problem. We're really committed to our veterans who served us so bravely, and we are opening a brand new Veterans Resource Center. It's going to be a standalone office located in the McDowell Center, which is our primary building for all student service offices. And the Veterans Resource Center will have everything a veteran needs. They'll have their own academic advisor. They have their certifying official for all their benefits, as well as we have a visiting VA benefit specialist from state and local. So they come a couple of times a month, and if a veteran needs help with, let's say, housing assistance or medical needs or anything vocational, these specialists come and work with our veterans. No charge, it's complimentary, and we have a private area for them to meet with them.
Well, that's
we're really excited, Lori, about opening this up.
No, that's exciting news, and I wanted to make sure you got that out. And how does one find out more about Schoolcraft College?
Sure. Our website is very easy. It's schoolcraft.edu. And if they just put in the search, once they get to the homepage, just type in veterans, they'll get to our veterans homepage. But once they're on that page, we also have links for them to apply, to look at our different majors, and to look at other resources that we have.
Oh, that's great. Again, we at Veterans Radio are thrilled to have Schoolcraft College on board as a sponsor. We're very excited to be able to shine a light on all the good things you're doing at Schoolcraft College and certainly the new Veterans Resource Center, and we encourage folks to use that website and check you guys out. And thank you for joining us this Sunday afternoon.
Oh, thank you for having me, Jim. I really appreciate it.
That's fantastic.
You have a good day.
You too. And we're going to move right now to Bob Gould. My co-host is normally in the studio with me, but he heard I was having pilots on this afternoon, so the old Army dog decided he'd do a field remote. Bob, how you doing?
I've been up to my eyeballs in pilots, although it was very exciting. I was at the Yankee Air Museum. And, folks, I know the air show's over. I know that. But you can always go to the Yankee Air Museum. They've got a wonderful display, static displays. And it was very exciting to see the Thunderbirds. And I also want to welcome Schoolcraft College, because what I'm about to talk about is going to take place at Schoolcraft College this Wednesday and Thursday. We've been talking about it for weeks. It's called the Boots to Business. Now, what is that? Well, you know, you think about, I'm working and I got an idea for how I can have my own business. Well, how do you know if it's going to work? It'll cost you thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars if you go to consultants, buy a book, buy the tapes, oh, Lord, or go to the seminars. You don't need that. Your government, that's right, they're going to give us something. I know, but the government's going to give us some. Department of Labor and the Small Business Administration, along with Syracuse University. Doesn't get any better than that. At Schoolcraft College. I mean, isn't that great, Jim, all these institutions coming together?
Well, I think it's only appropriate that they're out there trying to support our veterans every way they can. And that's what this Boots to Business reboot is about. This Wednesday and Thursday. These are all-day programs, aren't they, Bob? I mean, this is
yes,
a rigorous...
they are, but more than that, they take away the BS. They get right to the point. Should you do it? Should you not? It doesn't mean you have to have something. Maybe you got an idea. Is it feasible? They go through all that. It is a two-part Wednesday and Thursday. It is intense, folks, but I just really encourage you to go out and get that info. I'll give you that number in just a moment. But what they found is veterans are natural entrepreneurs. They're disciplined, goal-oriented, self-starters. They're accustomed to accountability. They know how to be decisive and flexible. All what it takes. Jim, you're a small business guy, right?
You got it. What is that number that they can call to?
Okay, we
got to
move along, right?
You got it.
Here we go. Now, you should always have a pencil when you listen to Veterans Radio. Here we are, 313-324-3605. Only one person's going to pick up the phone, the guy who's running it. If you want to get online, it's Boots to Business. The two is a numeral. Boots2Business.org. Boots2Business.org, 313-324-3605. Thanks for that time, man. I'm really excited about this.
And, Bob, did you have anything on the upcoming Canton Foundation Summit that you wanted to pass along?
Oh, Lord. Yes, that – let me get my little – yes, that's coming up on September the 10th over at the Laurel Manor, September 10th. It's the fifth time, you know, and it was so refreshing to hear that benefits people now. Because that was one of the problems with the VA. They just didn't have enough people to give folks the real truth and how you get out and get things. Well, here, you can bring all your questions about pension. You can bring your questions about your spouse. That's right. They're covering spouses. In certain situations, spouses and children can now receive health care. You want to know all about that? Well, you want to go to the 5th Annual Veterans Summit, Laurel Manor. Here's the number. 734-495-1200. 734-495-1200. It's all about VA eligibility, health care benefits, pension benefits, burial benefits. That's right, the governmental burial. Boy, that's a great deal right there. Whew, it's been a whole lot.
Thanks, Bob. We appreciate the
field
report. We're going to be right back with Colonel Seidel to talk about the A-10 airframe right after this on Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. I'm thrilled to have available to talk to you Colonel Roger Seidel, retired. Colonel Seidel, born in Louisiana, but heart is in Michigan. He spent quite a number of years over in Battle Creek. He's quite an accomplished Air Force and Michigan Air National Guard pilot and commander. Roger, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good afternoon.
It's great to have you on board to talk a little bit about a particular airframe that you know a whole lot about, the A-10.
And yeah, I'd be more than happy to, you know, spread a little bit of knowledge on the A-10, what has gone through.
Well, let's talk first a little bit about your personal history with the A-10. I know you've got a lot of hours logged with it and been in it with decades of experience. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I started flying with the United States Air Force in 1977, a few years after the A-10 was fielded. My first assignment was Myrtle Beach Air Force Base in South Carolina, one of the first operational A-10 wings in the United States. I've got over 4,300 hours in the airframe. We gave up our A-10s here at Battle Creek in 2008. Also have about 700 hours in the OV-10. Flew the airframe in Asia, two assignments in Korea, Republic of Korea. Also, got 8 combat missions over Bosnia, flew at Southern Watch, and was part of the groundwork for the A-10 as far as some of the tactical employment processes with it.
Listeners, Veterans Radio couldn't have a more knowledgeable guest on relative to the A-10. Colonel, tell us a little bit about what the pluses of the A-10 are, what its mission was and is, and what you found in all those thousands of hours of flying. What were the pluses of this airframe?
Well, the airframe was pretty much designed based upon lessons learned out of Vietnam, looking for an aircraft that would be designated for the role of close air support. As the airframe was rolled out, of course, the attention of the military was towards the Soviet Union. And, of course, everybody's training for the forecast full-to-gap scenario. We started training low-altitude employment using standoff munitions, and the common joke with the A-10 pilots was that if we had any free-fall ordnance, such as dumb bombs, that they'd be jettisoned at the end of the runway, and we'd go forward with the gun, and at that time, the Maverick.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that that gun. It really is the sort of heart and soul of the A-10, isn't it?
True. Designers like to say that the airframe was developed around the gun. It's about the size of a Volkswagen. It went from two rates of fire, with the max rate being 4,200 rounds per minute, down to a single rate, because they felt tactically there was no need for two separate rates. It can fire about 3,900 rounds per minute, about 54 the first second, then spins up to about 70 rounds per second. It carries 1,150 rounds, and now with the lead computing sight, it's very effective at long ranges. In the old days when the airplane first came out, it was pretty much an iron sight, and you had to use what would be comparable to Kentucky windage.
So not so sophisticated is what you're telling me.
Yeah, it was a very simple airframe. It was meant to be operated off of forward operating locations in Europe, very close to the front lines. It could turn off of these austere runways, and there were several of them located, as I said, throughout Europe, and basically looking at about a 4,000 to 6,000-foot runway, and the airplane's pretty much self-contained, so that all you need to do is upload the gun with an external load system and slam some bombs up, some gas, and you're on your way.
Well, there's something to say about simplicity, isn't there, Colonel?
True. I mean, if you take a look at the safety record of the airplane, it's pretty phenomenal. I worked in the safety arena for 2 years, and initially the airplane had some growing pains. Individuals flying at low altitude with some of the visual illusions with the aircraft resulted in people actually flying the aircraft into the ground in high bank turns. But over the years, very reliable. It's gone through numerous upgrades, and right now it's got a precision bombing capability that makes it comparable with most jets out in the close air support arena.
Roger, one of the other features of this is, in terms of close air support, is its ability or lack of ability on speed. Talk to us a little bit about what the A-10 can do on speed.
Well, that, you know, since its inception, though, we jokingly call the pointy nose mafia, or the fast movers, such as those that were flying the F-4s, F-16s, and F-15s. You know, of course, they were built for specific missions, and most of those were deep strike or strike behind enemy lines. When you're dealing with close air support, it's critical that you get eyes on target. Of course, that's been enhanced now with some of the targeting systems where a lot of that information can be data linked. But when the airplane first came out, it was pretty much what we call the Mark I eyeball, talking to a ground controller to try to get your eyes on the target, and going much faster than 300 knots would make that very difficult to try to acquire the target. As a result, the airplane was also built to withstand damage. I mean, several aircraft were damaged significantly during Iraqi freedom, and they made it back. Numerous sorties, and one A-10 was lost, and that happened to be from our unit, and pretty much you had half a tail and one whole engine blown away. But there had been cases where the A-10 returned with holes in the wings where you could actually stand through them. And in one case, an individual also lost his engine. But the airplane was designed with redundant capability to withstand hits.
And we have seen here in the mid-Michigan area, we've seen the A-10 flying around because it's had a couple of bases that have used the A-10. Maybe you can talk a little bit about its history at Battle Creek and at Selfridge.
Yeah, the A-10s came to Battle Creek in 1991, and it replaced the OA-37. In the period of 1991 to 2008, the wing deployed in support of Operation Allied Force, which were missions over Kosovo. Prior to that, we sent two deployments in missions over Bosnia-Herzegovina, and then we had two deployments over Iraq. And our last deployment, a year before we moved the A-10s out to Selfridge, we deployed airplanes over to Afghanistan. In 2008, as a result of BRAC actions, the aircraft were transferred over to Selfridge. And since receiving the airplanes, they've deployed forward in support of operations over Afghanistan.
So has got a real history here in the Michigan Air National Guard and been very successful airframe from what I know of it. Is that the way you'd call it, Colonel?
Yes, very successful. Again, the airplane is relatively inexpensive to operate. It's very reliable. I know Selfridge had to give up their F-16s when they received the A-10s. And, the F-16 is a fantastic airplane. But considering the options, I think A-10s were well received over there.
So using your terminology, the pointy nose mafia, would that be those jet pilots running things at the Pentagon?
Well, there are a few A-10 drivers that are definitely making some decisions. I believe General Welch flew the hog for a while. But the A-10, has been the redheaded stepchild, if you will, and no offense to the folks that are redheads out there. But because of the nature of the beast,
the general wanted
when
to
you
make
talk
sure
about
you added that in.
Yeah, when the Air Force looks at air power, of course, one of the prime tenets is you need air supremacy or air superiority. You know, lessons learned the hard way on bomber raids over Germany. But once that's accomplished and you put boots on the ground, we've learned firsthand that, air power, the ability to strike when and where needed, is critical. My son was in the Army, and, I always kept that in mind, having been a mud mover all my life, that those men and women on the ground depend on us. And the unique thing about the A-10 community is that's the number one mission. That's all we do. A lot of these other airframes have swing roles, the F-16 has a myriad of missions, and so day in and day out, they train to those different missions, and they do it very well. But with the A-10, it was specifically close air support first.
Now, the A-10 Warthog, Roger, is known by many as the ugliest warplane in the Pentagon fleet, and there is a movement afoot to cancel the program out and retire the, I think there's, 280 or so A-10s left in the fleet, to retire those out and move to one of those pointy planes, right?
The bottom line is, the money has been identified for example, the F-35. That's your next swing roll fighter. It's supposed to replace the F-16. It's supposed to absorb the A-10 mission. There's a lot of discussion about the CAS mission itself. I found it very interesting that nobody wanted to do the CAS mission prior to Iraqi freedom and enduring freedom.
And CAS is close air support.
Close air support, right. But eventually, when there was no more air threat and it became from an air power stand, a relatively permissive environment, close air support pretty much was the only operation in town. And the next thing you know, you've got large aircraft starting to do close air support that would have never dreamed of it before. And the proper use. I mean, we use whatever we have out there, and, there's pros and cons of all airplanes. As long as I've flown the A-10, the number one knock on it was it wasn't survivable. And you're right. I can develop a scenario where no airplane survivable. But the A-10 is not meant to operate in and of itself by itself until certain things occur.
So let me jump in, Colonel, sure. Because we're running to the bottom of the hour.
Right.
And on the A-10, and should it be retired? I guess as I looked at the materials, it seems like maybe it's in an inter-service rivalry thing. Maybe it's about sequester. Maybe it's just about the A-10's old and not sexy enough. As you've looked at this debate, where do you think it comes out? What's the driving force behind retiring this very reliable airframe?
Well, in my humble opinion, it all boils down to support for the airframe. If you take a look at the F-35, the F-22, state-of-the-art, but the difference is, and they did it very well, as they did with the F-16, they sold it to foreign military sales, which provide support, and the development of the aircraft involves a lot of states. The A-10 was built by Fairchild up in Hagerstown, Maryland, and of course that assembly line has closed, I think it was about 80-81. In order to go out and get upgraded parts to the A-10, you got to go to subcontractors. These other airplanes have numerous contractors, subcontractors. So the bottom line is there's not a lot of support from the military industrial base to do much more for the A-10. So it makes it easy, very, very easy to remove the airplane.
Well, unfortunately, it sounds like an airframe that is perfectly designed for close air support, has a great flying record, a safety record, and plenty of years of service may go away simply because of those kind of factors that that you mentioned. Whether or not that's the ultimately the right decision, I guess, Colonel, it's not yours and it's not mine, is it?
True.
Roger, I really appreciate you having the time available for us this afternoon. I know you're an expert as it relates to this airframe. You have probably over 5,000 hours of flying time, plenty of hours in combat missions all over the globe. You're a true patriot, and we at Veterans Radio are really happy to have you on board this segment, and I'm sure we're going to have you back again. Thank you for your time.
And thank you for what you do for the veterans out there.
You got it, Roger. Thank you.
Take care.
And folks, we'll be back on Veterans Radio shortly to talk about another Michigan pilot, Michigan-born pilot, Memoirs of a Korean War Ace with his co-author, Major David Vaughn, who also is a Michigan pilot. So I think, again, in honor of what we've been doing this weekend out at Thunder over Michigan, we've got a great group of pilots from Michigan here to talk to you about this next segment. So we'll be right back on Veterans Radio. Thanks for tuning in, and don't forget to like us on Facebook.
This is the Blaze Radio News. I'm Dave Perkins.
If you're a troubled young individual in the West.
Analyst Eric Stakelbeck talking about the appeal among young angry men of the violent terrorist group ISIS.
Someone who's grown up playing violent video games. You're going to be attracted to this. If you're a young Muslim who feels disaffected, for example, what ISIS is doing, beheading people, putting heads on stakes, Judge. This is unprecedented, really.
Stakelbeck characterizing the problematic appeal of violent terrorist groups among young men today. Day as jihadi cool.
These guys are on Facebook. They're on Twitter. It's all a big joke. They make it seem so cool to go overseas, become part of the caliphate. It's a very dangerous thing.
Stakelbeck appearing on Fox News Justice with Judge Janine from over here in the West. ISIS looking scary, but they might not be quite so tough. In Iraq, Kurdish fighters taking back two towns from the terrorists, Mahmur and Al Gwer, two villages near Erbil in Kurdish northern Iraq, now back in the hands of their own people. Well, no problem. Problem today finding critics of President Obama's policy towards Iraq and ISIS. The Blaze Radio's Tom Pease with one of the big voices.
Former UN Ambassador John Bolton says the president's handling and response to ISIS so far is inadequate.
And I think it's a further piece of evidence that the president's just not paying attention and hasn't been paying attention.
He says Obama's objectives in Iraq do not include a coherent plan to deal with the threat of ISIS.
But the real point, I think, is that it doesn't fit into any kind of coherent plan, at least not anything that the president has announced, to deal with the threat that ISIS poses first in Syria and Iraq, but almost certainly in short order thereafter in Western Europe and the United States.
Bolton on Fox's Justice with Judge Janine. I'm Tom Pease, The Blaze News.
Rory McIlroy on the course and with the lead Sunday afternoon at the PGA Championship. I'm Dave Perkins. This is news on the Blaze Radio Network. Truth.
Our veterans put everything on the line to protect our freedom. And while we can never fully repay them, we can make sure that they're armed with the right information to succeed. Michigan veterans of all ages are invited to attend the Canton Community Foundation's 5th Annual Veterans Summit Wednesday, September 10th at Laurel Manor in Livonia. There they'll find out about the VA benefits to which they may be entitled, as well as having veteran service officers available to meet with them one-on-one. For more information or to register for this free event, go to cantonfoundation.org. And once again, for more information on this free event, go to cantonfoundation.org. Thank you for your service. Applebee's Restaurants is a proud sponsor of Veterans Radio. For the best in family dining, you'll want to make any Applebee's restaurant your destination for just plain good food, good service, and complimentary military discounts. So plan your next delicious out-to-dinner meal at Applebee's. That's Applebee's Restaurant. They help Veterans Radio deliver our program to you.
And welcome back on Veterans Radio. We're thrilled to go into this next segment. We've got David K. Vaughn on the line. David, say hello to the Veterans Radio listeners.
Hi, folks. Glad to be with you.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. Let me set this up a little bit, and then we'll start talking about Mig Alley to Mugai Pass, Memoirs of a Korean War Ace. But before doing that, let me tell you a little bit about our guest. David graduated from the United States Air Force Academy. Now, this is a good young man at that time from Muskegon Heights in Oscoda. Went on to have a distinguished career in the United States Air Force. Retired as a major. I think you had over 3,500 hours of flying time. He flew the big boys. He flew the KC-970, the B-47, and the C-130 throughout his career. David has been pretty much all over the world in his role as a Air Force pilot, and flew missions and airlift missions in the Philippines, Japan, Korea, Guam, Thailand, and South Vietnam. So this is, again, we're lucky enough to bring to our listeners somebody who's been there, done that, and has a great deal of experience. Interestingly, after returning from Southeast Asia, David attended the University of Michigan, received his master's in English literature, went on to teach at the Air Force Academy, picked up his PhD along the way, and after retiring from the Air Force, went on to teach English both at the University of Maine and at the Air Force Institute of Technology at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base down in Dayton, Ohio. So you've had a couple of interesting careers, David. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yes, I have. I have to thank the Air Force for both of those opportunities. I joined, survived the rigors of the academy because I was motivated to become a pilot. After some, not very exciting years flying KC-97s and SAC, I was able to get into C-130s and see the real world and the real Air Force, and that's my favorite airplane, and that's the one that I flew in Southeast Asia. But fortunately, the Air Force was also, through my interest in opportunities and openings that were available, I was able to pick up the master's degree at Michigan, yes. Nice to be there in the fall of 1968, and just the year before, I think, Bo Schembechler arrived, had a good football season that year, almost went to the Rose Bowl, got beat by Ohio State in the last game. But anyway, Air Force then sent me for my PhD to University of Washington out in Seattle, great place, and was able to teach at the Air Force Academy, and then I entered my academic teaching career in writing books mostly about airplanes, which is why you got a hold of me, I think, because of my connection with Cecil Foster.
It absolutely is. McFarland Press has a book out that I mentioned a minute ago, Mig Alley to Mugai Pass, Memoirs of a Korean War Ace, that you co-wrote with Cecil Foster, who we want to talk about. He's a good, grew up in mid-Michigan, and so did you, and looked skyward and said, geez, I'd like to fly someday. Where did that, how did that idea come about, right? It obviously motivated you and gave you a great career. And let's talk about Cecil Foster a little bit. Where did he grow up, and how did he make his way early on in the world?
Well, Cecil had a very tough childhood. He was raised in the Midland, Michigan area. His family was had many relatives in that area. There's still several relatives remaining in that area. His mom died when he was very young, and his father had a very difficult time trying to run the farm and keep track of Cecil and his brothers and sisters, and had to farm them out to other family members. He struggled and obtained a minimum education in Michigan. Then when World War II came along, the first years of the war, he was too young to sign up. But by 1945, he was of draft age, and so he volunteered to go into the Army, and in his testing, he showed he was eligible to join the Army Air Forces and was accepted as a navigator, interestingly enough.
And he actually gravitated, didn't he, to navigation a little bit because he thought that's where the smarter guys were going.
That's right. The test that they gave you in those days said you got to be smarter than a pilot to be a navigator, and I think many navigators probably would agree with that.
I also find it interesting that maybe that aptitude that he developed on the farm and in the conditions that he had to grow up in sort of helped him have those innate abilities. Do you think when talking to him while writing this book, you think he saw a correlation there?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. He came from tough circumstances. He worked hard on the farm to support his family members, to get himself an education. His family was did not have much money. He got into the Air Force, and I think he was a little disappointed that the war ended before he really had a chance to do anything else other than just complete the training program. But he was able to apply for and be accepted for pilot training just as the war ended, even though the Air Force was downsizing, the Army Air Forces were downsizing significantly. He was able to get a slot into pilot training and complete his pilot training at a time when most of the training programs were being shut down.
So Cecil Foster grew up in a hard environment, gets into the Air Force, the war's winding down, opportunities seem limited. Was he the kind of guy who complained about it, or did he do something about it?
It's amazing to me. He just kept his mouth shut. If he complained, he just complained to himself. He said, okay, if that door closes, let me find another one that might open. And so eventually he was able in one of his early flying assignments after World War II to fly the P-80 when he was briefly assigned to Alaska. He got up to Alaska, paid out of his own purse to bring his new wife and child up there. And no sooner had he been up there for a little less than a year when the Air Force said, okay, we're getting rid of a whole bunch of pilots, and you, Cecil Foster, are one of them. So basically he had to leave the Air Force. He went to become a civilian for a while. He tried a job at selling life insurance, and that really didn't appeal to him very much. And then something called the Korean War started, and he said, you know, there's these ads I see saying they need navigators and pilots, so I'm going to apply and see if I can't get back in. And he did just that, and he was initially brought in to the Air Force as a navigator, because I guess that may have been listed as his primary AFSC, if that was what they referred to their numbers in those days.
But Cecil had a hard time getting back into the Air Force because of the problem with his records, didn't he?
Yes, his records got lost. They said, well, we don't have any record of you. We're not really sure that you really were in the Air Force during World War II.
So we have, anybody who's ever been in the military, like you and others, we all know that the Department of Defense loses records all the time, and our veterans on Veterans Radio have heard about the VA losing their records all the time. So did Cecil just give up when they told him his records were lost?
No. He said, okay, I'll find some more, or you know, I'll show you the copies that I've got, because he did keep, like any normal person, kept copies and had copies made, and was able to convince the folks that yes, he really had been in the Air Force, really was qualified to be a navigator and to enter the Air Force. And once he finally got his foot in the door, and they said, yeah, I guess you really can be a member of a flight crew here. Once he talked to somebody that knew something about his background and believed what he said, those folks said, hey, you know what, we need you more as a pilot than as a navigator, so we're going to send you, to pilot refresher training at Nellis.
And that's what he wanted to do anyway, wasn't it? He wanted to get out of the navigator seat and into the pilot seat.
Yes, he did. He realized that the navigator might be smarter, but the pilot was the guy that drove the airplane. So that's always a better position.
So he got his training at Nellis Air Force Base, and he got to fly the F-86, I believe it was.
Yes, he had about 10 hours in F-86s, and they said, okay, you're ready for Korea. Go to it.
You didn't need a whole lot of training at that point, I take it.
Well, the Air Force was a little desperate there because they had found out that the other side had come up with an airplane called the MiG-15, which could outfly and outperform and outshoot any other airplane in the Air Force inventory. And the Air Force really didn't have anything to compete with it. P-51s were a sleek airplane, but P-51s were no match for the MiG-15. And the F-86 was just, actually, it was still being developed. Had a number of problems. They had things, A models had slats that sometimes worked right and sometimes didn't. It was kind of a work in progress on the F-86, but they knew that that was the only machine they had that could really keep up with the MiG-15, so they sent them over there, and they sent the pilots that could fly them, and Cecil got over there in the summer of 1952 and soon became one of the better-known pilots in the organization over there.
So before we talk about his exploits in the F-86 Sabre jet, let's talk a little bit about the MiG. The MiG was a Russian military aircraft, I understand.
Yes, it was. It was a phenomenal design. It was way ahead of its time. It could reach altitudes up to 50,000 feet, unheard of, you know, for an aircraft to get to at that time. Had terrific speed, and the reason it was able to do that, of course, was a powerful jet engine, swept back wings, and that it was very light. It was made out of a relatively thin metal framework construction, which allowed it to fly to such high altitudes. The F-86 was heavier, sturdier, not quite as maneuverable in many instances as the MiG-15, but because the F-86 was sturdier, it could take more hits from a MiG-15 than a MiG-15 could take from an F-86 if the F-86 pilot was clever enough and smart enough to know how to shoot it down.
There's an important feature there. So, but before we go there, let's talk a little bit about the speed. Who had the speed advantage in the MiG-15 or the F-86?
Well, the MiG-15 had the speed advantage. Both could go quite fast, but the problem was when you're up above 40,000 feet, and I know this from flying T-38s and pilot training, the air is a different environment up there. If you want to maneuver and stay in the air, you can't just yank and bank like you can at 20,000 feet.
And we're gonna come back and talk about Cecil's Foster's record against those MiGs right after these announcements.
Schoolcraft College is proud to have served the communities of Southeast Michigan for 5 decades. So it should come as no surprise that they're just as committed to serving those who have served our country. Schoolcraft College Veteran Services provides assistance to veterans using their educational benefits. They help with the VA benefits application process, provide academic advising, and plan programs of study according to VA guidelines. Classes are forming now in Livonia and Garden City. Visit schoolcraft.edu for more information.
And we're back. Today's Veterans Radio program is sponsored by Legal Help for Veterans, your only stop for veterans disability assistance, the Canton Community Foundation, Schoolcraft College, Applebee's Restaurant, a great place for family dining, and Len Pitlack, CPA for over 25 years serving our community. All of these friends of Veteran Radio, so please patronize these fine entities. So, David, we were just got to the point where it's the Russian MiGs flown by pilots from the Russian Air Force.
Yes, they were. They were being flown by the Russian pilots. I think it was a matter of being better trained and not wanting to lose the. They felt safer having Russians flying the aircraft than the North Koreans flying the aircraft, and then they might return more safely. Though I think I haven't done a lot of research in that area, but I think there were some North Korean pilots that flew as well.
May of 1952, and Cecil arrives in South Korea.
Yes, he arrives in South Korea at the very end of May. He has an in-briefing from Colonel Francis Gabreski, who is the wing commander. Gabreski had been was well-known as a result of his aerial success in World War II, and of course, was another pilot who had flown out of Selfridge before the war and after. He was very well-known in that area. But Gabreski was there just for a little while. They had a new wing commander, but basically Cecil then sort of served his apprenticeship for the first 3 months that followed, June, July, and August, flying as a wingman to an element attached to the element lead or the wing the flight leader, sort of learning how the aircraft worked and learning the ropes. Basically, the F-86 had just about enough fuel to take off from its air base near Seoul, South Korea, fly up along the Yalu River, the border between China and North Korea, where most of the MiGs were based out of. And they basically didn't have enough fuel. They had enough fuel to get up there and maybe do a couple of orbits or more, and if nothing was happening, then they would turn around and go home and fly back to South Korea and hope that they would land before they ran out of fuel.
Well, there's a pat on the back and good luck for you, right?
That's right.
Now, this things started to heat up for him from September 1952 to maybe January of 1953. He sees a lot of action. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yes, he had. He started off as things like this sometimes can in an unusual way. He wasn't the day that he got his first MiG, which was September 7th, 1952. He wasn't scheduled to fly. He wasn't even on alert status. He was coming into the ops shack, wanted to listen to the comments of those who were on patrol. They were close enough that they could hear some of the comments over the radio coming into the base. And all of a sudden, there was a call for somebody to go out and help them deal with all of these MiGs that were circling around. They were chasing them south, unusual procedure for the North Koreans, the MiG pilots, to actually give pursuit to the F-86s. So they put together a flight of four, of which Cecil was going to be the element lead, and took off, and one of them had to fall out because a gear couldn't be retracted. So then that was the flight leader. So then he took over as a flight lead, but then he had three aircraft, and so one of them had to drop off because you really didn't want to go in with three. You wanted a wingman, and you wanted to go in pairs. And so there was just two of them, and so Cecil and his wingman are heading north, and they get to see some of the MiGs heading towards them, and he was at something like 38,000 feet, which is up there at the upper level of maneuverability. And like I say, when you're engaging with enemy aircraft at 40,000 feet or above, you got to turn very slowly, very cautiously. You can't yank and bank or you'll stall and fall out of the sky. So it takes some skill to know how much bank you can make in there and still not lose altitude if you overbank and you can't be jockeying your throttle because you might end up with a flame out. So.
When these pilots went up in the F-86, did they feel they had superiority over the MiGs? In reading your book, I was surprised at how many planes were in the air at any given time. There'd be tons of MiGs in the air. But I was wondering whether the guys went up thinking we have superiority.
Well, they never knew what to expect. There was no set pattern on the part of the MiG pilots. They'd go up there sometimes and there wouldn't be a MiG in the sky, you know, perfect weather, and there wouldn't be anything up there. And they'd come back and say, we didn't see anything. And another time they'd go up there and they'd say, well, there's 15 or 20. And then a couple of times there would be as many as 40 or 50. And one occasion somebody said there was as many as 100 MiGs up there. Now, I don't have the details about why the MiG pilots or the commanders decided that would be, you know, they'd put that many aircraft up. I think maybe they were trying to maybe scare off the F-86 pilots, but I think the F-86 pilots by this time had figured out that they really did have a pretty sturdy aircraft. They could take a fair number of hits, if it didn't hit anything too vital, and still keep flying, but they knew by this time also that if they put their shots on the engine, in the fuel tank of the MiG was going to stop flying, and it was going to be all over. The F-86 could take a much more of a beating than the MiG-15 and still fly.
Well, we just had a segment on the A-10 airframe, and Colonel Seidel is telling us one of the values of that airframe is it can take a beating. So I think you're repeating a lesson here that one of the advantages of the F-86 was it could take a beating.
Yep.
And in terms of number of kills that Cecil Foster had, tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Okay, well, he is credited officially with 9 MiGs shot down, which is a pretty significant achievement. He's not ranking as the highest MiG ace on the list, but he's certainly not. He's not one that got 5. He got 9. He almost he could have stayed if he wanted to get more, but his MiG kills were spread out over that period between September and January. He did get a MiG on his first MiG on that mission where he sort of got launched at the last minute. But what you see in his account that you can read in the book was that he knew where to shoot. He knew how to lead the target. He knew when to shoot, and he was quite good at that. He got his second MiG on the 26th of September, so a couple of weeks later. He's now been promoted to commander, D-Flight commander. He was in the 16th Fighter Interceptor Squadron in the 51st Wing, so he's moved up to a position of some prominence. His experience and the fact that he shot a MiG down give him the credibility and authority, even though he's still a pretty relatively young guy at the time. He's just a lieutenant, and he's leading flights containing captains who have theoretically more experience or at least more time officially in the Air Force than he has. When he got his next 2 MiGs on the 26th of September, it was one of the most unusual events that I know about in the Korean War. He actually shot down 2 MiGs with 1 burst from his guns, from his aircraft. How did that happen? He was shooting at, because he had got a new airplane and he was watching the tracers, and he was shooting at his tracers, and he saw his tracers miss the lead aircraft. He was coming up on the left side. And he was shooting at a 2-ship formation, 1 MiG in the lead and another MiG off on the right side. And he saw his tracers hit the second MiG. And he's waiting for something to happen in the second MiG, and all of a sudden the first MiG blows up. And where did that come from, he asked himself. And pretty soon the second MiG it falls out of the sky. It, too, crashes. When he comes back and lands, he finds out that he's flown an aircraft that was so newly arrived that they really didn't have time to boresight all the engines in, and the tracers he was watching hit the second MiG. The ones he didn't know about hit the first MiG.
There you go. That's a little bit of good luck. But let me ask you, in walking through this story with Cecil Foster, was it your sense that he was particularly daring or foolhardy, or was it something else that made him a great American pilot during the Korean War?
Well, he was definitely not foolhardy. He didn't take a risk that he thought was not worth taking. But he did understand how to engage with the MiGs, and the important thing was he wasn't afraid to take advantage of an opportunity when he saw it. He never seemed to worry about, well, maybe I'll get shot down if I leave my formation a little bit, take my wingman and move out of the formation with the rest of them and engage with this MiG. He didn't seem to worry about that. And I can't say that there's a lot of pilots that would be able to think in that mode.
Well, before we run out of time, David, I wanted to make sure we covered sort of, I guess, a theme that I saw in the book and in your storytelling here is that Colonel Foster made it many of his own breaks. He didn't wallow in disappointment. He just went out and did his job.
I really admire Cecil. He is just the most modest man you'll ever meet, which is very unusual for a fighter pilot, which is, you know, another reason I like him. We got hooked up, by the way, because his nephew was a faculty member of mine at the Air Force Institute of Technology, and so that's how we made contact. And Cecil finally said yes, he would be willing to have me help him work on a book about his experiences. And once I studied more about his background, I said, "Oh yeah, the world needs to know more about you, Cecil."
Well, I agree. The book was a great read. You did a great job with it. Can you quickly tell the story about the Cuban Missile Crisis and the loading of the nuclear weapons, but having enough thought process in that by Cecil?
Well, he had an unusual situation. He was a fighter pilot. He came back from Korea. He got a job as an air defense interceptor, flying another version of F-86s, and then he got stationed in Europe for a while. He was a staff officer in Germany, came back to the States, and got assigned to the Air Defense Command. And there he was flying F-101s. It wasn't primarily his primary duty, but he kept his proficiency in F-101s. So he flew some interesting aircraft. during the Korean, Cuban crisis, he was told to take a flight of about four or five other aircraft loaded with nuclear weapons to a dispersal base in Billings, Montana, which was a civilian field.
Now, that's a little story I've never heard before. I'm reading through your book. I get to that point, and I go, whoa.
and it was so heavy that the aircraft, because the airfield wasn't stressed, the tarmac and the areas around the base ops weren't stressed for heavy aircraft. So their aircraft are sinking into the tarmac because it's warm enough that it can't support the weight of the aircraft. So he's got to move the aircraft periodically to make sure they don't get stuck in the tarmac.
This is, as I said, just one of the little stories that's in Mig Alley to Mugai Pass, Memoirs of a Korean War Ace. It's the Cecil Foster story written with our guest, Major David Vaughn, retired. I probably should call him Professor Vaughn. It's a great read. It's still available out there. Was on the internet today and found it. David, I appreciate you taking some time on a beautiful August Sunday afternoon to tell us about this story, and I really think you did a great job of capturing a Michigan, Midland Michigan boy who just continues on and on and on to make sure he gets things done. He doesn't give up. He doesn't get discouraged. I also want to thank you, David, for your service. Another good Michigan man who goes on to the Air Force Academy and a distinguished career in the United States Air Force. These are the kind of stories we like bringing to our listeners at Veterans Radio. We're going to have you back to talk about your own book. And with that, listeners, you are dismissed.